morning. How lovely to have a full house. I'm sure it thrills you. Come on up. Mr. Taubman, how are you?
Good morning, Your Honor, and thank you. May it please the court. The primary issue in this case is whether the President's recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board were constitutional and whether the Board had a lawful quorum to rule in this case. Before addressing the recess appointments issue, I understand that the Board and the intervening unions have challenged petitioners' standing to bring this appeal. Petitioner's reply brief addressed those concerns, explaining three independent bases for petitioner's standing. First, their personal injury, in fact, from being forced to mail repeated objection letters after their continuing objections were denied. Second, the unremedied injuries to an entire class of similarly situated employees, which gives them standing, as in this court's real estate tester cases, and cases like Bloom and Cecil from sister circuits. And finally,
well, now the caption of the NLRB complaint and the caption of your petition for review don't mention others similarly situated.
Your Honor, the NLRB's, well, if you go back to the very beginning, the ULP charges that were filed in this case all seek remedies for similarly situated. That's early in the appendix at, I think, pages 9 through 11. If you then look at the NLRB's complaint, it alleges that this was a union policy that affected not just the charging parties, but employees generally. The complaint says that.
Here's what really interests me. You compare the petitioners to class representatives, but even class representatives can only represent the interests of those who are similarly situated. How are the petitioners similarly situated to persons who lost their objector status by failing to renew? I mean, isn't this situation fundamentally different from the cases you compare it with, in which class representatives experience a change in circumstances during the case, which renders them no longer similarly situated? Because here, the petitioners were never similarly situated to them.
Well, Your Honor, there's many answers to that question. First of all, the only reason that these charging parties, that these petitioners, were treated as objectors is because they succumbed to the illegal policy and sent new letters every year. And so that puts them in the same class of all of these people who were subjected to the same policy.
No, similarly situated. No, here's our problem. The petitioners here always renewed their objector status, and therefore they're not similarly situated to those who suffered injuries for failing to do so. You know, the cases that you've cited, as I noted, in which class representatives were allowed to proceed, although not suffering the same injury, are inapposite because they involve situations in which the class representatives were similarly situated at the time of their filing, but their situation subsequently changed. And the petitioners here were never similarly situated to those who failed to renew their objections, and they never had a right to assert a claim.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully say that the injury is being subjected to this policy which denies your continuing objection. Each one of these charging party petitioners submitted continuing objections. They were denied under the policy. The fact that they weren't flipped because they succumbed to the policy doesn't take them out of this similarly situated status. But I would like to actually get back to the first ground by which we have standing, which
I'm still concerned with the point that Judge Rovner raised, because I'm trying to identify aggrieved parties, and it seems to me the workers who actually want the refund should be the ones who bring the appeal.
Well, Your Honor, my clients didn't get flipped because they complied, but Again, it's the overall workings of the policy. If you look at the unfair labor practice charges, it was an attack on the policy.
But see, I thought a fundamental aspect of standing was you had to be an aggrieved party.
Okay, now I...
And they're not.
Well, actually, they are.
I mean, they are, according to you, under the policy, but in terms of the harm...
Well, Your Honor, they are harmed, and I want to go back to that, because even if we forget about the class action issue, my clients are aggrieved because they were forced to send certified letters year after year to the union after their objections were denied, after their continuing objection was denied. So they expended money and effort to have to comply. Now, if we get the make-whole remedy that we say we are entitled to, when the case goes back to the NLRB on compliance, then they will be able to apply for those refunds.
Look, setting aside the factual issues let me put it this way. It seems to me what you're arguing is that these people suffered a monetary injury and that they had to pay to send in their renewal by certified mail. And so now they're entitled to seek this retroactive monetary relief for out-of-pocket damages. Well, if we set aside the factual issues with that, because it appears that you used certified mail because they didn't trust the unions, not because it was required to, you know, renew your objector status. They can't rely on that because they've never asserted any request for such out-of-pocket damages. The union interveners here filed a supplemental appendix that includes in full, you know, their exceptions to the board, and neither seeks any such reimbursement. The only retroactive relief, it seems to me, that has been sought before the board is for agency fees collected as a result of the denial of their continuing objection and the improper switching of them from objector to non-objector status. And the only claim for retrospective relief is for dues wrongly collected from persons who were wrongly switched to non-objector status. And accordingly, the petitioners can't now, in the reply brief, claim standing based on a damages claim for out-of-pocket costs that never was asserted prior to this time. So I'm...
Your Honor, I would like to respond to that, and I have an answer to that, and I can respond to that. The board and the intervening unions mischaracterize how board litigation works. Board litigation is a bifurcated process in which, in the first stage, which is where this case still is, you ask for a make-whole remedy. There is no requirement that you have to specify in advance the precise damages that you would claim if you got the make-whole remedy. They don't say that, and they are mischaracterizing how board litigation works. And let me point, Your Honor, to something else. We filed our motion for reconsideration. The board knew exactly what we were asking for. If you look at the supplemental appendix 24 and 25, which is the board's denial of the motion for reconsideration, if I may read this to Your Honor, it says, charging parties request reconsideration of the board's remedy, arguing it should encompass all current and past Beck objectors represented by the respondent nationwide. They argue that the respondent should be ordered to recognize all such objectors as continuing objectors and to provide them with make-whole relief, including reimbursement of all dues and fees collected from them for non-representational activities, including, not solely limited to. And the point is, when you get a make-whole remedy from the board, there's a bifurcated process where it goes back to compliance, and they are ignoring that. I just read a case, Your Honor, where back on compliance, the board issued out-of-pocket relief to charging parties in the form of reimbursing a woman for her eyeglass frames because the employer had, had stopped a health plan. I guarantee you that nowhere in the first part of that litigation did anybody file a paper saying, and don't forget this woman's eyeglass frames. It doesn't work that way in board litigation. It's a bifurcated process where you seek and get a make-whole remedy. Then, in the second stage, it goes back to compliance, and that's where you first raise your issue. So this idea that we didn't raise a claim for out-of-pocket expenses for having to comply and mail letters, we were never required to. They cite no rules for that, and I cited in my brief the NLRB compliance rules that talk about the bifurcated nature of this, and we cited that in our reply brief. The Iron Workers case out of the Ninth Circuit talks about the bifurcated nature of this. So I respectfully say we've waived nothing, and we have always asserted a complete make-whole remedy, and that is to be determined later as to what the damages are under that make-whole remedy.
I'd like to go on to some of the merits, actually, because you do not have much time.
I understand, Your Honor.
And maybe you can help me with this, because under your argument, couldn't either the House or the Senate essentially shut down the ability of the executive branch to function by the House failing to approve any recesses or the Senate failing to characterize any absences as recesses and refusing to approve any nominations? And I have been banging my head against a wall trying to figure out how that would be consistent with respect for the balance of powers. And, you know, we judges are very into that issue.
I understand, Your Honor, and thank you. There are several constitutional overriding principles that go into answering your question. The first principle, number one, is that the founders of this country created a joint appointment power between the executive and legislative branches to diffuse power. They denied the president, they specifically denied the president the unilateral power to make nominees, and they gave the Senate veto power over nominations and said that the Senate could withhold consent for any reason, good, bad, or no reason at all. The recess appointment power is a supplement to that and is purely conditional on the Senate's power to declare a recess. And in answer, in direct answer to Your Honor's question, the Office of Legal Counsel opinion at issue in this very case says that the president has no guaranteed recess appointment power and that the Senate can completely negate any recess appointments by continually remaining in recess. By continually remaining in session. And secondly, in New Process Steel, former Solicitor General Kagan told the Supreme Court that the Senate can deny all recess appointment power by holding sessions like these every 3 to 4 days. So I think the short answer to your question, Your Honor, is yes, the Senate can prevent the president from filling appointments, but that's part of the way the founders set up the country.
If the Senate is not willing to remain in active session, it cannot prevent the use of the power of recess appointments. And, you know, I really looked at that parade of horribles, such as, you know, presidents characterizing lunch breaks as recesses. Forgive me, but that's pure fantasy.
Well, Your Honor,
democracy, I mean, I hope it's pure fantasy.
Well, I hope it is too, Your Honor, but in this case, for the first time in our nation's history that I am aware, a president has said that sessions that Congress scheduled and held and passed legislation in were invalid for constitutional purposes. The third principle that I would make is that the founders gave each House of Congress the power to make its own rules and convene and adjourn as they saw fit. Congress has this power under the rulemaking clause and the adjournments clause, and the cases that we cite, Balin and Marshall Field, speak directly to this. The government cites YouTube videos and would have the court look at these short congressional sessions and decide that they're not really sessions. But in the cases like Marshall Field and Balin, where litigants came in and said, well, we know there really wasn't a quorum, so that law is invalid, or the two houses voted on legislation that had slightly different wording in them, the court said, we don't get into extrinsic review of how Congress does its business. The Congress has the power under the rulemaking clause to do its business as it sees fit. And for one branch to say that these sessions were constitutional irrelevancies and nullities grievously disrespects a co-equal branch of government.
So then when we look at the Senate's own adjournment order that says it's in recess, what you're then asking courts to do now is to examine the extent of the business. It says it's still in session, but it's not doing any business. And so isn't the Senate having its cake and eating it too? I mean, that's what the order says. They're in recess, and it gives the date.
Your Honor.
So every time that happens, so we're then to go back and figure out, are they doing a little bit of business? Is it a lot of business? My understanding is I think there was one bill that was passed during this period. That was it.
Honor.
So we can't look at the Senate's own adjournment order and trust that it means what it says.
No, actually you can, and that is our position.
Because that pro forma is just for temporary sessions, you know, those 2 or 3 minute sessions in the interim, but the order says the business will resume in January, gives a date, and says when it ended.
The order says that sessions will be held. They were held, and in fact legislation was passed. So any claim that the Senate was incapable of conducting business or unavailable to conduct business is plainly wrong. And it is the government that's asking this court to act as hall monitors. It's not us. The Senate is entitled to set up whatever sessions it wants, and it's not for another branch of government to say that those sessions were shams. I really would like to save time for rebuttal, so. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Brickman. Come on up.
Good morning. Actually, I'm Ms. Beard.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
I don't know. You can shake your finger at me. I figured I'm from the National Labor Relations Board, representing the board with my colleague Beth Brinkman from the Department of Justice. And since Your Honors seem interested in the standing issue, I figured I would start with that.
Great. Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. Don't use the explanation up as time. Okay. Go ahead.
We request that the court deny the petitioner's request for review of its orders. Now, one of the things I want to address right off the bat is my opponent indicated that the board misrepresented its processes. With regard to standing, what's important to remember is to come into an Article III court is quite different from coming in front of the administrative agency of the National Labor Relations Board. And the injury, in fact, has not been demonstrated in this case, except for in the reply brief, we're told of these certified mailing expenses that two individuals had. Now, these two individuals and their mailing expenses, clearly in the board's bifurcated proceedings, if there had always been a request for make-whole relief encompassing those kind of expenses, there absolutely would be a compliance hearing. We've never misrepresented that. And in that hearing, damages would be determined. However, in the context of this particular case, throughout the board proceedings, the mailing expenses were never encompassed as part of make-whole relief. Indeed, the very phrase make-whole relief throughout this case, as set forth by charging parties, was always in the context of those who were flipped for dues. And if you take a look not only at the supplemental appendix, but at all of the pleadings that have gone before the board in this case, it was litigated as a case where the make-whole nationwide relief, the board was on notice that the nationwide make-whole relief they sought was for those who were flipped for the dues. Now, I do understand that at this point, they're now saying that the main thing to get them in to their injury in fact here in the court is the mailing expenses. Let's take that for a moment. Let's say that was a valid injury in fact at this point. There's still other requirements of standing in an Article III court, one of which is redressability. And this is where we get to the argument of waiver. If this court is not likely to remedy something that they have sought as their injury in fact, then they have not met the prong of redressability. And under the 10E requirement of our Act, when parties present things in front of the board, they must put the board on notice with specificity of what it is that they are asking the board to give them that they didn't get earlier. And in the context of this case, we would submit that the make-whole relief that they asked for was always make-whole as constituted by those who were flipped for dues. And I can cite two pages of the joint appendix, if Your Honors would like, that would indicate exactly where... Okay. So we'll start with supplemental appendix A4, I would say A5, supplemental appendix A7, and then into the complainant's own motion for reconsideration on A10, A11, A13 through 14, and A15, and in the request for relief, it's always if the agency has collected excessive fees. So for purposes of standing, we submit that they have not met the injury in fact, for none of them had been flipped. The mailing expenses they never specifically requested as part of make-whole relief before the board, thus it's not redressable for standing, and therefore that they have failed to meet the standing requirements to come in to this court. I'm also prepared to discuss the merits of the actual board's decision and order if this court would like to hear that. My colleague Beth Brinkman is going to discuss the recess appointments. But I think that at root of this case, if you ignore the standing arguments, which we think are very strong, the board's decision and order here is well within the board's discretion. There was no evidence ever presented of anybody flipped in this policy.
I hope I'm asking the right person this question. What standard would you propose that the courts should use in determining whether the executive may characterize the Senate as in recess? Is it a common sense practical analysis, or is there some more objective test that could distinguish between a session and a recess?
Well, Your Honor, with regard to that question, I would ask you to ask Ms. Brinkman on that particular piece of the merits, anything having to do with the recess appointment. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Well, okay. For the standing determination, I'm going back to the standing. Is the comparison of petitioners to class representatives an appropriate one?
No, Your Honor. We do not think that it is. There is no mechanism in front of the National Labor Relations Board for parties to bring a class action. Now, in this instance, they are correct. In the charge, the charging parties did want similarly situated individuals brought in. And this case was litigated by the General Counsel, which is how our cases are litigated in front of the National Labor Relations Board. And the General Counsel did not ever ask specifically for relief on behalf of the class. Now, there are cases that have been cited. The Bloom case that they cite for the proposition of class action status, I would point out in that case, there was still an individual injury. In fact, Mr. Bloom still had something due to him, which the charging parties in this case do not have. So Bloom is distinguishable. And to the extent they cite the Cecil unpublished decision from the Sixth Circuit that there's a class representation analogy to board proceedings, we think that case is wrongly decided and believe that the Orse case in the Second Circuit, where the Second Circuit found that a case was not litigated as a class action in these types of circumstances, is the proper analysis, and that here the whether or not there is even a class injury, we would maintain for Article III standing in this court, none of the cases that they have cited obviate the need for the complainants themselves to have their own claim of injury in fact.
So you're not saying there can never be a quote, class action type litigation before the NLRB. It's just that here you don't have an aggrieved party that adequately represents
that. That is correct.
That's your bottom line.
Is correct. There's no official certification in front of the NLRB for class actions like there would be in district court for sure. But there are cases where individuals come in and the general counsel asks for and the board grants broader remedy than just that one individual. But to come to this court under Article 3 for injury in fact, these charging parties do not have their own cognizable claim of relief, and that's not obviated by any of the cases that they cite, nor of any of the board's procedures. And that's why we would urge that if you get, you know, that the standing issue demonstrates that they should not be here, and we believe the case can be dismissed on those grounds, and that to the extent the board's order was well within the board's discretion, we would ask that you dismiss the case on standing, and if you reach the merits, find that the board's order was within its discretion. And I would like, if I could, to cede the remainder of my time to my justice.
You don't have any more time.
You're done.
Well, then she will come up later. Thank you very much.
But as you're leaving, of course, the NLRB complaint, that was in a conscious decision not to put similarly situated in the complaint the NLRB filed.
But the general counsel did issue the complaint,
right.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You just want to mix us up. You're Mr. Kaufman.
I also am not Beth Brinkman, but I'm going to be talking about standing. My name is Jim Kappas for the
Oh, thank heavens. You're not Ms. Brinkman. Okay.
Outstanding. One is that the supplemental appendix that Ms. Beard referred to is one that we filed recently with the court in which we included all of the materials that the petitioners relied on in their reply brief to assert that they had requested general make-whole relief. We submit that if the court looks at that material that they relied on, there's no way to interpret it to include what they say it includes. They asked for a very specific type of retroactive relief, namely that anybody whose objection had lapsed be reactivated. And in their motion for reconsideration, they're particularly clear about this because they say, we got the relief that is due. Our objections will continue to be honored. Everybody else should get what we got. So they are admitting in their motion what's obvious, which is they were asking that their objections continue and only that. And they just never raised the mailing issue. The other point I would like to make is that it would have been impossible to litigate the mailing cost issue in this case because things proceeded unusually quickly. The complaint was issued and the hearing was held in this case before the 1 year elapsed on their initial objection. So the renewals all occurred after the fact. They have, in fact, been continuously treated as objectors. There would have had to have been under the board's order if they hadn't been. So they've received all the relief they're due. If there's someone else out there in the world who feels like their objection should have been honored, then that's the person who would be have standing to petition for review and not the charging parties. If the court has any questions for the union about the situation or the merits, I'd be happy to answer them, but those were the two things I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At last.
May it please the court, I am Beth Brinkman. I'm from the Justice Department here, also arguing on behalf of the NLRB to address the recess appointments clause issue.
Would you start with my question, which was the standard?
Yes. Your Honor, when you look at the long history tradition and the common sense understanding of the recess appointment clause, we look at the text and the functional approach that both the Senate itself in a 1905 report and the Attorney General's opinion from 1921 address. And the question here is whether or not the President's appointments to the board were made during a recess within the meaning of the clause. Private parties here challenge the validity of actions taken and say that the appointments were invalid. We look to determine whether it's a recess by first starting with the common ordinary usage of the term recess in the Constitution, which means a break from business. The January 2012 break of 20 days here easily meets that definition. As Your Honor pointed out, the Senate's own order stated that no business would be conducted during that 20-day period in January of 2012. And indeed, the Senate proceeded and treated it as that. No business was conducted during those 20 days. They were not acting as a body. No communications from the president could be laid before the body at the time. They were held and laid before the Senate on January 23rd when they came back. The members had no duty of attendance. They were allowed, under the provision of the unanimous consent that no business be conducted, to leave and return to their constituencies with a guarantee that business could not be conducted.
Or take a vacation if they felt like it.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Or take a vacation and go fishing if they felt like it.
That's true, Your Honor. That's right.
They don't
right.
have to go back to their constituents if they don't want.
No, they don't, Your Honor. That's right.
Pity.
And during that time, there was no debate, no speech, no votes at all during that 20-day period. In fact, if you look at the December 17th congressional record where this order is entered, setting forth the recess, there are two other orders on that same page that refer to this as a recess. They're unanimous consent orders, making clear that that period is viewed as a recess.
What about counsel's point that there was that one piece of legislation that was passed?
That piece of legislation, Your Honor, was not passed during the January 2012 session. It was passed during the December session. The two periods are not one recess because the sessions of Congress changed on January 3rd by operation of the 20th Amendment. So I may have misspoke before, but the January 2012 recess began on January 3rd. The earlier recess in December was part of the first session of the 112th Congress. So whatever impact that may have had does not influence the January 2012 recess. The pro forma sessions that were held during the January 2012 recess also do not undermine the nature of the recess for purposes of the Recess Appointments Clause. As Your Honor pointed out, the that type of Senate mechanism cannot trump the balance of powers between the executive and legislative branches.
Well, should the courts be in the business of determining whether the legislative branch or the executive branch is properly characterizing its status as a pro forma session or a recess in any event? Or is that the type of political question that would enmesh us in, you know, the business of those branches of government, and it's not for us to be determining?
No, Your Honor, there's no clash between the branches here. There's no indication that the Senate has declared that it does not view this as a recess for purposes of the Recess Appointments Clause. There is no rule, no proceeding from the Senate at all. In fact, when you look at the indicia from the Senate, the official indicia, you look at the congressional record from December 17th, there are two other orders that refer to this recess. You look at their order that says no business is going to be conducted during this period, and you look at the view of Senate as an institution since the 1905 report that looks as at a functionality of whether or not there's a resource. Was there any duty of attendance? Was the Senate acting as a body? Were communications from the president laid before the body? No, none of that was true. So under the Senate's own analysis and test and standard, this constituted a recess for purposes of the Recess Appointments Clause. We would also point out that the design, it would be contrary to the purpose and the design of the Constitution. The Constitution's purpose of the Recess Appointments Clause and the Appointments Clause is to ensure that the authority to appoint officers is at all times vested somewhere. But under petitioner's view, that would not be the case. On the one hand, they would allow this to render meaningless the President's Recess Appointments Clause authority, and yet the Senate is unavailable to exercise the joint authority under the Appointments Clause. That would be contrary to the balance and the structure that the Constitution set up. We would also point out that if the pro forma sessions were this ability to render meaningless the President's Recess Appointments Clause, it really runs so contrary to just decades, if not centuries, of negotiations and political compromise, which all would have been for naught if, in fact, this device of a pro forma session could somehow trump the President's unilateral appointment authority under the Recess Appointments Clause. And when you look at the structure that was set up, you see that the President's Recess Appointments Clause are appointments of limited duration. The Senate retains its ability to act on nominations, and indeed, the Senate can remain in actual session and able to exercise joint authority. But when the Senate is in recess, by looking at the fact that there is no duty of attendance, it has by order of unanimous consent directed that no business be conducted. Communications from the President are not being laid before the Senate. It is in recess for purposes of the recess appointment clause. We don't think there's any kind of political question here presented, Your Honor. As I mentioned, it's not a conflict between the branches. And moreover, there are standards to look at, as we've discussed, as our briefing makes clear. And the 11th Circuit in Bank opinion in the Evans case, where it addresses the recess appointment clause issues, indicates there that a political question might arise, for example, if there was a challenge to a particular person being nominated, and the court there realized that one part of that case was a political question, can't start looking into the actual political reasons for appointing a particular nominee. But that is a far cry from this case. This is like the rest of the Evans case, which does not at all present a political question. If there are any questions, Your Honor? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Taubman, how much time? 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, on the standing issue, again, I just want to make a few points and hopefully correct a few thoughts here. First of all, if you look at the complaint that the General Counsel issued, they don't use the word similarly situated, but for those of us who litigate NLRB cases, it's the equivalent of a complaint that is broader than for these individuals. And I cite Appendix 17 and 18, where the complaint alleges that there are other employees, not just – there's allegations specific to these charging parties, but then in paragraphs 11 and 12 and 14, they talk about the union's policy affecting employees or objecting non-members. It's not just about these charging parties. And then they ask for all other relief as may be just and proper to remedy the unfair labor practices. So there is a quote, class action component here. Secondly, when they say, if we had only made a request for make-whole relief, we would get a compliance hearing, except we did request broad make-whole relief. And as I read before, the board, in its order denying the motion for reconsideration, said, we construe this as a request for broad make-whole relief for everybody. They are now parsing the filings that petitioners made, but the board understood exactly what petitioners were asking for. And then finally, with regard to the recess appointments, the Department of Justice hasn't explained why a Senate session can be valid for some constitutional purposes and simultaneously invalid for others. And that's what they're actually saying here, that these sessions could have been valid for the adjournment clause purposes, were valid for the 20th Amendment purposes, but were invalid for purposes of the recess appointments clause. And I personally don't understand how you can have sessions that are valid for some constitutional purposes and simultaneously invalid for other purposes. With that,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank all parties. And the case will be taken under advisement, of course.